Thank you, Lord, for this beautiful day, this Lord's Day that you have reserved for us to wait upon you, to worship you, to learn trust and dependence upon you. Today, as we look into a very important and relevant topic of those of us who live in Singapore, how to witness and interact with religious and ethnic others. Father, I pray that you may help us to equip us further in order to make our witness relevant to those around us. So we pray for your help. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, this is the topic for today, living as Christians in religiously diverse Singapore. And, of course, we have to address this topic with the Religious Maintenance Act of Singapore. Okay. And with that in mind, there are many, many more restrictions in terms of what we can do, what we cannot do, or say and cannot say in Singapore with regards to Christianity being the one true faith. In the United States, of course, it's quite different. The context, there is no Religious Maintenance Act, and we are given the so-called freedom and the right to speak freely. And religion is practiced freely, but that goes so far as even people attacking other ethnic and religious others, which is also counterproductive, you know. So this is something we need to do. Our witness needs to be appropriate and relevant in the context in which we live, all right? So with that, what are some of the key questions when it comes to dealing with religious diversity? I'm going to introduce a few ideas for you this morning. One is recognizing religious diversity in Singapore. And then I will introduce a topic which is called religious pluralism in Singapore. They're two different things, but they're interrelated. All right. So first, what are some of the questions regarding religious diversity? We live within an environment of religious diversity. We need to ask a basic question. Given the many choices, why should someone be a Christian? All right. So if you take a look at where I live on a floor. We have about 7 or 8 different apartment buildings on the floor that we live. And as far as I know, I'm the only Christian. The others are all mostly Indian and I presume Hindu background, okay? Because I smell the things that they... all these burning of incense, you know. And then they're cooking, they open the doors, and I said, wow, it's just very powerful, you know. So, and then I don't see anyone else. I think everyone is of Hindu background. And then next to us, immediately adjacent to our apartment, is a new family from Japan. And they, you know, they put things on the doors that suggest that they, on Christmas, they put a cross. And then they also celebrate Halloween, you know. And then they celebrate a number of other things, you know. And so I don't know what their religious background is. So how do we interact with them? How do we talk with them? And how do they view us, or how do they view me, right? So these are very important. But the fact is there are so many religions in Singapore. Given all these choices, a market of choices to make, why should someone be a Christian? So you look at a very important sociologist by the name of Peter Berger, who used to teach at the Boston University. He would say that we do have a problem of belief, and it not only raises a question of why we should believe in God, which is what the United States is dealing with, atheism, why they should believe in God. But in Asia, that's not even the right question to ask. The question in Asia is that why should we believe in this God? Because most Singaporeans they come from some kind of religious background. There's a high rate of adherence of Singaporeans to different religions here in this part of the world. But in the West, of course, is atheism and Christianity, but of course also growing numbers of Hindus, Buddhist, and other traditions. And so we need to ask the right question. We're not dealing with, per se, atheism, but why we should be, why is Christianity the viable thing? So Leon needs to answer this question later on when you do evangelism, right? So is it true that social harmony in Singapore can only be achieved and maintained if religious followers refrain from making exclusive truth claims? That's what many people in Singapore say. At the academy, I met with the director of NUS. He himself, the platform for interreligious faith and dialogue at NUS, about a month ago. And he says NUS is developing a program or studies on Buddhism. They already have it. How many one of you go to NUS, by the way? You went to NUS? Okay. My question was, who is going to NUS? Okay, none. All right. So he came to our church. He says, I am of Roman Catholic background, and he is asking you, ORPC, to donate money to NUS to promote interreligious dialogue and studies, triangulating Roman Catholicism, evangelicalism, Buddhism, and I would imagine eventually Hinduism, something like that. So he wants us to now donate money so that the Christian wing can be added into their cohort. So he did an interview of me and stuff like that. And this is what is happening in this society, all right? Because he says, you know, there are, at the time when he came to interview us, or me, we had the Taylor Swift banner outside. I don't remember what the banner said, but it had to do with Taylor Swift. I didn't know that because I'm not a Taylor Swift fan. And he took a picture of it and posted it on social media and said, you know, this is how Christians are. They're more worried about Taylor Swift than they are of their God. You know, I said, oh my goodness. And this went on viral. I don't know on what, but I think I saw it on Instagram or something like that. Wow. So how do we interact with people when we say this is our God and we're also peddling, you know, presumably commercialism and entertainment, you know, things like that. Okay, so how are Christians to live and witness to Christ in religiously diverse Singapore? This is the numbers, the profile of religious traditions in Singapore, as far as, and they're quite accurate and up to date. Buddhism is the highest at 40%. Non-religion, I would imagine that would be what do you call those people? Free thinkers. Yeah, free thinkers. Actually, many of the free thinkers are Buddhist. Because Buddhist, some wing of Buddhism doesn't believe in a God, so they just, but they're from Buddhist background, but they say they're free thinkers. Christians is 18.18%, 18.3 actually, and this includes Roman Catholics and some Christian cults, as well as evangelicals. Muslim, Chinese, and this is Chinese Bai Sun, the traditions. You know, more, I think, would be Taoism would be the closest. Hindus, Sikh, Baha'i, I'm not even sure what Baha'i is, but it's a kind of a universal kind of a thing. And then I think profile, the authorities did not include migrant workers. But if you factor in, migrant workers actually comprises of 37% of the population in Singapore, coming up to be around 1.42 million in a country that is around 5.7 million, something like that, right? So that's a high percentage, but they're not factored in. And I would imagine that many of them represent various different religions in the world, okay? So this is the extent, and Singapore is famous for being religiously and ethnically diverse around the world. And a lot of articles on culture and religion, ethnicity, have been written around the world about how Singapore is a model a successful model on how people can coexist together, even though they are very different. Okay? So how do we deal with this difference? So now I introduce this topic of religious pluralism. So it's one thing to say that we're different. How do you reconcile the differences? Or can you? Right? How do you account for religious diversity? How do you account for that probably every single one of these religions say, maybe not all, but most of them will say that their God or their gods or their path is the only way. How would we, as Christians who believe that Jesus is the only way, the life and the truth is the only way by which we come to God the Father? Right? I mean, you're going to have a lot of clashes, right? And how do you reconcile that? How do you live with it is really what religious pluralism is talking about. So this is Karen Chin, not related to me, but she's a Singaporean. In her article, Seeing Religion with New Eyes at the Asian Civilizations Museum. How many of you have been to that? You should visit. I don't even know where it is. Okay. Very nearby. It's a very nice place. I've gone to eat in restaurants around there, but I've not actually gone into the museum. So if you go in there, you will see, according to this article and a number of other articles on the museum, depicting religions in Singapore as following. This is what Karen Chin says. She says, in Asia and even in cosmopolitan Singapore, religion still plays a major role in national affairs as well as in the everyday lives of many ordinary people. Singapore is a secular state, right? It's true, with a multi-faith and multi-ethnic showcase. The plurality of cultures, religions, races, and origins still has a significant impact on state matters such as the school curriculum, citizenship, education, and preservation of traditional cultures, right? So it is very important. It really holds a country together. But then this is what she says. Studies raise many questions and offer numerous possibilities for our museum educators to help visitors see religion with new eyes, not as exclusive sets of beliefs, but an ecosystem of diverse ideas bound by rich civilizations that are connected by centuries of trade and cultural exchange. So, Huiru, how do you make of this statement? Okay, what she is saying is that religion in Singapore, even though everyone says that their faith or their God is the only way, is really just a cultural phenomenon. No one can say that their way is the only way or the true way. No one can make an exclusive truth claim. They all come from the result of history, they're a result of culture, trade, and it's just a fabric of ethnicity that this is what it is, all right? So you have to learn to live with it. So when people say that their God is the only way, I mean, they're just being very narrow-minded. And Christians are viewed as being narrow-minded because we say that our God is the only way. Okay, you understand what we're talking about, right? How many one of you have heard an explanation like this, you know, in Singapore? I would imagine many, right? Okay, all right. So you can, some religions will say that, but not all, okay? Not all in Singapore. So what this statement is saying is that religions, when they make truth claims, is just relativistic. It's your perspective and my perspective. And everything is a result of culture and history, all right? So,
controversy is about what is it that makes you know do you know? I have an expression at the time, you know. I talk to youngsters, the young asking, how do you know what you believe is true?
Right. Yeah. Okay, so we're only talking about the religions right now, but you're right. It comes down to how do you know that your way is the only way, all right? Well, we start at the lower level first. We'll build up to it. You're right. So it's just to say that we are different. How do you account for these differences? What makes you think you know the best and we know differently, right? That's what we're saying here. So this is Professor John Hick, Oxford professor, and he passed away already. His name is John Hick. So the way he talks about this topic called religious pluralism is a way to account for the fact that no one knows everything. Okay, everyone only has a fraction of what they think is true. Everything is perspectival. Everything is relativistic. No one has an all-encompassing, universal, what theologians call meta-narrative. That means an all-encompassing narrative to account for everything that we see. Okay? So Christians, we have a meta-narrative, a biblical narrative, a biblical worldview that we believe, that or at least I believe, explains for everything. Okay? So he comes from in the UK, he was at first a Bible-believing Christian. Then he went into Buddhism, and then he became a pluralist, and he started teaching this in various different universities around the world. And so this idea of religious pluralism is a discipline, an academic discipline. And if you go to U.S., I don't think NUS has a religious studies department, does it? I don't think so. If they do, they would probably say this is one way to approach it. That is a discipline that claims all religions are equally valid. All paths go to the same place. Okay? To the God or to a reality, no single religion can claim to have the final word of truth. Okay, so that's very disturbing, right? Do you believe this? How do you respond to someone like him? How, when some of you have gone or will go to NUS, and when you come across teachers, and lecturers who tell you these things, how do you respond? Okay, so this is what he says on rejecting religious exclusivism, Christianity. Okay, let's just say, John Hick writes: if exclusivism were true, no one would expect empirical evidence to confirm it. Yeah. For example, the true religion would be more efficient at producing saints. So, in other words, Christians, we're hypocrites. But this, obviously, is not the case. Okay, you can see the text where he's citing this thing from. So he's saying that no one can say that your religion is true. If that were the case, then it should be very evident. You know, there would be a lot of transformation. Okay, but the fact is, Christianity is not very efficient or very successful in changing our people. So he goes on to say that the reason why Christianity cannot be the only one true religion, and we cannot even know what is the one true religion, is the fact that if you look at it empirically, it's the fact of religious diversity around the globe. Okay? If your faith is real, your God is the only way, then Christianity should predominate. Right? It's a survival of the fittest idea. That's not the case. Okay? Islam is on the rise. Buddhism is still very strong around the world. Okay? Then he points out something very, very good, which is to say that he insists that religion and ethnicity are correlated. They're interrelated. So in other words, if you are of Indian background and you're from India, chances are you're going to be what? Hindu. Right? That's where Hinduism began, right? If you live in Sri Lanka, you know, you're probably going to be Buddhist, you know. And if you live, if you're from the West, chances are you're going to be maybe Christian or something like that, all right? The fact is, he is saying that these religion and ethnicity or race are strongly correlated. And it's hard to disagree with that. There's strong correlation. But as you can see now, with globalization, with migration patterns around the world, such as me, my parents are from China, I'm from Hong Kong, I migrated to U.S., I became a Christian in the U.S., you gave up your parents' faith in Buddhism and Taoism because you're from the West. Okay, is that true? I mean, there's probably some truth to that, right? And so they say, well, if you didn't go to the U.S., if you didn't go to migrate, and if you didn't, if there weren't this kind of a migration pattern, you wouldn't be a Christian today. You would still be in Hong Kong, and you would still be a Taoist. And so these are difficult to refute. But there is no doubt that migration patterns now with globalization is spawning a mix of religion and even in Singapore, Christianity is on the rise. And where did Christianity come from? Well, Billy Graham brought it in what, the 1980s? 80s, right? 70s. You know, they say, oh, is these are American, preachers and evangelists. They come and they, they bring this foreign Western religion on our people and this is what people say, is that Christianity is a Western religion. It's for the Ang Mo, Okay. I'm just telling you academically, that's what people say. All right. So, and then they say there's a lack of Christian missionary success. We've been a failure entirely in Japan. I mean, after how many decades of missionary effort to Japan, Japan's Christian population is still like 0.5%, less than 1% Christian. It's the most unconverted, the most unchristian Asian nation in this part of the world. But yet we keep sending missionaries there. It's like ramming ahead, on the wall, But until it becomes converted or it becomes Christianized or become more Christian, that's what people will do. They will keep sending people there, all right? And so Hick is saying, you just look at all this data, all these different ways of thinking, How can you Christians, how can you say that so arrogant and so assured that your religion, your God is true? It's a failure. And then he says, all religions are similar in that they teach God to be, teach people to be good. They say, you look at the whole thing, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs, Christians, Roman Catholics, Even though they are claiming different things about God, essentially the bottom line of what these religions are trying to do is to make people good people. Okay. So when my mother, I went to a mission school in Hong Kong. They sent me to a mission school in Hong Kong because they thought I would get a better education. English would be taught. The quality of education would be higher. So they paid extra money for me to go to a mission school. And so, and then of course in the mission school, like in Singapore, you would have chapel, right? And they would give a Christian message. So I was exposed to the gospel in that environment, just as many of you who have gone to ACS and I don't know where else you go to, here in Singapore. That's how you were introduced to Christianity. I didn't become a Christian because my mother said, no, you cannot go to church. But it's okay for you to go to a school and listen, but you cannot be a believer, and certainly you cannot get baptized, and so because that will cut your ties from, our home, your identity as a Chinese, as a Buddhist, because Christianity was a Western religion, okay? But he said, all these religions are all the same. They're just teaching people to be good. Okay, so religions that teach people to strap a bomb on their bodies and go and detonate it around, of course, that's not good law, right? So, but if you look at most religions, they're just teaching people to be good and moral people. How many one of you come from that background? Yeah, no doubt about it. And isn't it true to a certain extent? I mean, isn't that True, to a certain extent, that's what Christianity is teaching people, to be more Christ-like, right? We tell you this all the time. To be good, moral people. So my mother said, yeah, we don't want you to drink. We don't want you to fool around with women. We don't want you to go carousing, you know, and be a good, moral person, you know, be upright, da-da-da-da-da. So that's why they send us to a mission school, to religious school. So this is where a lot of it is coming from. And so this is exactly where Hick is coming from. You know, he's just saying, yeah, you know. And if that is really the end result, the outcome of religions, then isn't it a futile effort to say that anyone has the total marketplace on religion? Right? You cannot say that. And why in religious studies departments in universities around the world, why religious studies is even taught, and why religious pluralism is even taught in religious studies departments at Cambridge, Harvard. Harvard actually has a divinity school, and Oxford and these places, is because many people view religious exclusivity is actually harmful to global peace. Right? You can understand that. Extremists will kill and maim people. You know, if you go too far, this is all very, very bad. I mean, I lived through 9/11, 2001, right? I saw what happened. I wasn't in New York, but I saw it live on television when these buildings went down and when the second plane flew into the World Trade Center. And within 15, 20 minutes, everything just collapsed. I said, wow, what's going on? I thought it was a movie that was happening when I was watching it, you know? But it wasn't a movie. It was actually the newscast. So, and so, you Christians, I mean, we as Christians have also perpetrated many, many violent actions in the past with the Crusades in the 10th, 11th century, you know? And here, even in the modern age, we have religionists, you know, from different backgrounds, you know, perpetrating violence. I'm not going to say that what's happening in Israel and Palestine today, I mean, isn't that related to religion? To some extent it is, you know. So people say, you know, why don't we just, John Lennon, the song, I forget the name of the song, he says, I wish, you know, there would be a day when there's no religion, right? Some of you know the song. Anyway. So this is really the dream of the world when we can get rid of religions, because religion historically has been a very disruptive force in this world, very powerful and very violent. So don't think that religious pluralists like John Hick is just trying to be, you know, cute. He's actually trying to do something, you know, in promoting flattening the playing field where no one can say that they're exclusively right and no one can know that what they believe is true. Okay, you're tracking with me, right? Okay, so these are the reasons why religious pluralism is on the rise, and it's very evident here in Singapore as well. And so John Hick's model of religious pluralism, by the way, he's probably the most famous religious pluralist up until 5 years ago when he passed away. And so he has a lot of writing to his. So what is his model of religious pluralism? He basically says that in this world, there is some kind of a reality of a divine out there, the thing that he calls the real. All right. So in his book, one of his books is entitled God Goes by Many Names. God is called many names. All right. Because there is one entity, one thing out there, a reality, whether we call him God or a force or nirvana or whatever, or Brahman, whatever we call it, that is out there. But religions, whether you're coming from a Hindu, Christian, Buddhist background, are just different perspectives of this reality. Okay, but they're all legitimate responses to this reality out there, and because of our ethnicity, our background, our history, you know, our race, we have different perceptions of what this reality is, and we interpret it to be, you know, 3 million gods, 3 million deities. This is Brahman, or this is Nirvana, which has no god, you know, or we say this is Jesus who gives us salvation, you know. So religions are historically and culturally conditioned interpretations of this divine reality. No one knows for sure. And so therefore, when we talk about Christianity as salvation, or Buddhists say that their salvation is enlightenment, and some would be liberation, is understood as moral transformation of people from being self-centered to reality-centered. That's what religion is all about. It's just being, it's being changed to be good. And don't kill, don't steal, you know, don't commit adultery, be honest, work hard. And so when we do that, we become more reality-centered. Okay, this is very, very strong. It's a very strong argument. So this is his thesis, his main point. He says, the great world faiths embody different perceptions or interpretations, concepts, and correspondingly different responses to the real from within the variant ways of being human, and that within each of them, the transformation of human existence from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness is taking place. These traditions are accordingly to be regarded as alternative soteriological spaces within which, or ways along which, men and women find salvation or liberation or enlightenment. So in other words, there is a reality out there, but because of our history and background and culture, we just perceive things differently. It's all pointing to the same thing. Okay, we don't really know. So to answer, you know, the question, how do we know? It's because we don't know. So you use, again, this elephant, the man with a blindfold, feeling different parts of the elephant. You cannot see the whole thing. You're only feeling and experiencing certain parts, but you don't have a grand picture. So therefore, if you're Buddhist, you're from Vietnam or somewhere. I mean, where is a Buddha from again? India, right? India, yeah, India. So because he's from there, or if there was a Buddha, Gautama, if we're not even sure whether he was a real person or not, you know, if he had been another part, his perception when he sat under a mulberry tree and he reached enlightenment, if he were in a different country, maybe his experience would have been different. You know, because he experienced all the death and suffering, you know, around him, and he tried to figure out what is happening in this world. And that's how he experienced liberation or nirvana. Because of and he said, but it's because we because of desire and suffering, and we hold on to it, you know. And so this is just one way of looking at it. And so different parts of the world, of course, Jesus was born in the Middle East, you know, and because of the Apostle Paul, you know, he came to Troas, and he was deciding whether he should turn right or turn left, but he turned left, he went to Macedonia, into where? Europe, and that's where Christianity began. So all the Westerners, of course, became Christians because of what presumably the Holy Spirit guided him to turn left instead of right. He went into Macedonia and then into Europe. So this is really just because of chance and the fact that the European culture is Westernized and they believed in Jesus, etc., but that's really, no one has a market on that. So, but we still have to deal with conflicting religious truth claims, okay? There's no doubt of the fact that, so this is what he's trying to do, what Hick is doing, academically, research-wise, philosophically, to resolve any kind of religious differences. No one knows everything. Yeah, this is what I'm telling you now. Okay, because we live in a postmodern society. Youth, you don't believe in a meta-narrative. You don't believe in absolute truth claims. You only believe in perspectives, like what I see, what I experience. I can only see things from a certain perspective, and I don't have your perspective, and you don't have your perspective, and you don't understand me, so how can you say you know what I'm talking about? Okay, that's what we are open. I mean, that's what people believe today is postmodernism. Okay, no grand meta narrative. All right, so therefore, the question is, how do we as Christians deal with conflicting religious truth claims? Why should we as Christians continue to proclaim the gospel that Jesus died on the cross, rose on the third day, and give salvation to those who believe? All right. So obviously, Muslims believe that there is only one God, Creator God by the name of Allah. And the problem, according to the Quran, is that people fail to submit to Allah, and therefore creating suffering and evil. So, I mean, I think Islam basically means submission or something like that, right? And so it's our failure to submit to Allah. So that's really what the problem is, okay? And so Muslims believe that when people die, they will face judgment almost immediately, okay? Hindus, on the other hand, believe in Brahman. That's the ultimate reality. So that's very different now than Allah, okay? Allah is a creator God. There's only one God. But Brahman is not even a personal God. He's not a creator. He's an impersonal reality in everything. And there are millions or 300 million deities always being, you know, created and reinterpreted, reincarnated, etc., etc. It just keeps going on and on and on. Hindus claim that the universal problem is samsara, the endless cycle of birth and rebirth. It's causation. If you do bad things, this is what's going to happen to you. If you do good things, this is what's going to happen to you. So Hindus believe in reincarnation and reincarnation into different forms, not just to come back as a different person. If you do bad things now, the law of causality, the law of, it's not karma now, right? This is Buddhist. It's not called karma, right? Is a Hindu believe in karma? No. Yeah, they don't believe in karma, but again, you know, if you do bad things, there is a causation system, and you can come back as a dog or as a bug, and someone steps on you, wow, you're going to be suffering for a long, long time, you know? But this is the worldview, all right? And so Buddhists would believe in karma, meritous system, you know, you believe in, you do good things. So I go running. And whenever I go running, I see a lot of people, you know, they build these makeshift houses for cats along the streets. And I stop by sometimes and I talk to one and I said, it's great that you're feeding the cats and giving them shelter. Why are you doing this? Because it's a good deed, you know? It's really good. I mean, we should be benevolent to all forms of beings, all forms of animals, you know? So I think she's kind of like from a Buddhist background. And so you have these, I mean, and that's good. I mean, we should do good to others and be mindful of even animals. But they believe, obviously, in doing, doing good karma, good action, in order that you would come back in a better life. All right. But the fact is, it may take many, many thousands of lifetimes before you can even get out of this circle, this cycle of reincarnation, birth and rebirth. Right, so this is really one of the problems that we face. So, but Christians now, we believe in something entirely different. Nothing that has to do with Allah, nothing that has to do with Brahman, nothing that has to do with karma. But we believe that salvation involves being released from the bondage of sin and death. That the problem of the world is that Adam and Eve originally in the garden fell, rebelled against the Creator God. And because of that, death came into the world and suffering came into this world, and that he sent his son, the Lord Jesus, to die on the cross to pay for our sin, and that by faith in him, we will be released from this this bondage to sin, inherited sin, as well as doing bad things, and also released from the penalty of death, which is eternal damnation. Okay. That's what we believe. But as you can see in the way I just described it, all these religions are very different from each other, right? You can see that. Okay. So how do you deal with it? Religion, world religions manifest, no doubt, doctrinal and competing truth claims. Hick would say that all these different faiths are about the same and they all lead you to the same God or the same reality. Okay, whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian, religious pluralism says they're all valid responses to the real out there. Okay, how many one of you have heard that in your school or your place of work? Okay, yeah, right? You know, and I think this is how a lot of people, whether they actually are aware of it or not, or conscious of it or not, this is how many people view religions today, right? And so a number of articles have been published in the Straits Times, also in Light and Salt, that, Salt and Light, saying that even the Christian community, the evangelical Christian community, in Singapore, in the last, especially publications in the last 3 or 4 months, believe that there is truth in other religions. There is truth in other religions, and that perhaps they can be, just perhaps, a legitimate way to salvation, other than Christianity. Okay. These are from your denominations now. They took a survey of the 4 denominations and even non-denominations. Many Christians are believing in that. So how do we in Singapore respond? And that's why this talk was prompted by these questions. This is recent research, surveys taken by Singaporeans. So world religions manifest, but at the same time we say world religions manifest doctrinal and competing truth claims. So Professor Hick basically overstates religious resemblances and oversimplifies their differences. In other words, he just says the bottom line is that they're all the same because the end result, the end outcome is religions is to make people moral and to be good people. But the way to get there is that we believe in very different things. That's oversimplification, all right? Oversimplifying their differences. And so religious pluralism is then actually a form of imperialism or exclusivism. Because to say that, you know, all of you are wrong, only I'm right because I'm promoting a pluralistic agenda. It's a form of imperialism. It's a form of particularism. Okay? That's where this whole agenda fails, right? Because they want to flatten the playing field to say that all the religions are legitimate ways to the same reality, but they're actually saying my rule is now the new rule. Okay, so that's why it's not really a very valid way of looking at things. Okay, and of course, you know, it also disregards or oversimplifies any kind of a historical factuality among religions, you know. And so my question here is this. Do all religions lead to God? How many one of you have heard that even in recent days that other religions, there's some truth in other religions? How many one of you heard something like that? So the question is that do all religions lead to the same God? Can we know and experience the whole elephant and not just parts of it, right? So for Christians, God has revealed himself to all people at all time through general revelation. So you go through Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 2. It says, Paul writes, he says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. So in other words, God revealed himself to us through creation. God created the heavens and the earth, right? And he said he revealed himself to us, but because of our ungratefulness, we suppress that truth of God so that when we look at creation, we look at the beautiful sky, we look at the great ocean, we say, no, that's not from God. That is just a result of evolution, all right? But Paul is saying that if you look at the creation out there, if you look at it with a God point of view, you say, wow, how can this be the result of evolution? This cannot be, you know, it has to be some, you know, very intelligent, powerful being who created everything, you know. How do humans come about? Such complex, you know, beings, you know, evolving from a single cell to something like us, is this really possible, right? So Paul is insisting that God revealed himself to all people at all times. But the problem is that we suppress that truth in our, you know, God's revelation. So God's grace, if this is true, God's grace is evident in every culture. He has not left himself without a witness. So does that mean religions are ways of salvation to the Creator God? Because God has revealed himself to us through creation, and he has revealed himself to us in Jesus and in the Bible. All right. So if you just take this general revelation, then you can probably say, yeah, I think, you know, we can know something about God in general revelation, but you don't. It cannot take you all the way to accepting or even knowing Jesus. But in the past, there's a Roman Catholic statement called Nostra Aetate, which sort of implies that the religions are actually ways to salvation. Implied, not explicit. That, you know, whether you are a Hindu or a Muslim, these are ways that, you know, because of the different background and cultures, these are ways that will lead people to the ultimate religion, which is Christianity. And that's how most Roman Catholics will see different religions today. They say they shed light on some truth of who God is, even in these different religions. But the highest, the greatest revelation is in Jesus. And the others are just sort of stepping stones, preparing people to accepting Jesus. Right. So I don't know how many one of you have heard something like that before. No, huh? Okay. So Roman Catholicism would take it that way. Pluralists would take it in a certain way. And these are just different tactics or different ways, approaches on how we view religious diversity in the world. All right, and so you see the Pope, he'll go to different countries, and once he touches down, he'll kiss the ground of that country, you know, the pavement, and he'll have interreligious dialogue. He'll work with different religions and different religious leaders to promote peace and to even share the gospel with them, because these are not entirely completely different. They're just preparation to receiving Jesus at some point. Okay. Jesus fulfills all the other religions. It's how Roman Catholics will see it. I wonder if anyone from a Roman Catholic background can share something about this. Anyone? Okay. Aren't you from Catholic High? Oh, no. Okay. Yeah. All right. But the point here is that, you know, God shows himself, reveals himself in some way, although limited and maybe very finite or even in a twisted way, in these different religions. How many one of you would be comfortable with that? Wow. Okay. So there's nothing that reveals God in these religions, huh? Okay. So this is where it becomes quite controversial, right? Let me jump to this book, okay? Oh, I better not. This book I want to introduce to you is by Gerald McDermott. And this is the thesis of his book. He says, this book addresses the problem of truth and revelation and takes serious the normative claims of other religions, explores biblical teaching that Jesus is the light of the world, light that enlightens every person, and that God has not left himself without a witness among non-Christian traditions. So in other words, because God revealed himself at all times, at all people, to all people. So then he says, you know, there is some smidgen or clue or fingerprint of God, even in false religions, or what we call non-Christian religions. And you just have to pick it up in order to build a bridge to talking with them. So for example, he would say that, you know, Christianity, like Islam, we believe in a Creator God. So how do you engage with Islam? Talk about Creator God. That's your common point of interest, your entrance. And Buddhists, you know, Buddhists believes that you really cannot know external reality out there. Everything is an illusion, right? And so we tend to have a very narrow-minded perspective of what reality is. And Christians, not similarly, but kind of similarly, we believe that we really cannot know Jesus unless God opens our eyes. So are there no common little beginning points, you know, of how we can engage with religious others? And so for my mother, if you come from a Confucianistic background, like probably many of us are, all right? So we, in Confucianism, what kind of virtues would, let's say, be similar to Christianity? So in Chinese, I can only speak Cantonese. So we in Cantonese, we have this concept called 君子 or 专子. Okay, what does that mean? Huh? Noble person. A virtuous person, right? Yeah. So in Confucianism, there's already something like this in their culture. In Christianity, we also have a number of virtues that we want to be Christ-like, you know, to be a 君子, you know. Do you know anything? Huh? Gentleman, a gentleman. We are something like that too. We want to be virtuous, to be a gentleman, to be a benevolent person, right? Isn't that similar to Christianity, right? So this is what McDermott is saying. There are some smidgens of religion, of truth in other religions that are, you know, that can be an entrance in talking with them, common grounds, right? So this is what we need to do, you know. We need to still, how should we bear witness in religious diversity? We need to witness to the gospel. It's not an option. So the Cape Town commitment of the Lausanne will say that we remain committed to the task of bearing worldwide witness to Jesus Christ and his teachings. We send missionaries out, right? Christians are to bear witness in accordance with God's love. That means in a religiously diverse country like Singapore, even though we all say that Jesus is the way, is the only way, but we do it in a loving way. We do it in a respectful way. We don't ridicule, we don't put down or denigrate other religions and other religious others, okay? Because why? Christians believe that God is the source of all love, and we are to call to love others. That's a misspelling there. To live lives of love and to love others, neighbors as ourselves. So we don't do anything destructive, and we commit to preaching the truth, but we can preach the truth, but we just don't say other people are bad or they're wrong, right? So this is how we propagate the Christian faith. Christian witness must be respectful of others and conducted with humility in a multi-religious environment. So I think this is, you should all be very well aware of this, right? Unfortunately, in the U.S., sometimes when it comes to religious dialogue and interaction with others, the rhetoric can become quite sharp and disrespectful and engenders violence, you know? And so that's not what we should do, all right? And so Christians should include appropriate forms of even inter-religious dialogue. In our society, which happens at all different levels of society today, in order to build common understanding, perhaps find ways that we can work with each other, even though we believe in very different things, work with each other to promote a prosperous nation, so to speak. So how should Christians interact with other people? Where do Christians draw the line, if at all, when it comes to participating in religious rituals of other religions? Should you, when you go to a Buddhist funeral or wake, should you bow? Should you do the incense and the joss sticks and the joss paper, you know? Should you go on the procession following the monk? Should you chant, right? Another question. How should Christians respond to invitations to participate in community functions where members of other religions are present so as to foster community cohesion? How many one of you have been invited to other religious events in within your community? Oh, no. what was the invitation for? Did you go?
No.
I mean, yeah, how do you take up invitations like that, right? And so these questions are very big, especially when it comes to the first question. To what extent are there boundaries when people invite you to participate in their funeral rites and wakes and funerals? I don't know. What do you think? Shirley, you're shaking your head. You don't do it. They don't. Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, you go through the motion, but you don't believe, huh? All right. Okay. Yeah. So what is your answer? You already answered it.
Yeah.
So there's no strict answer or clear answers as far as I'm concerned. I think we as Christians need to be very wise and not draw a hard line. This is what you can do. This is what you cannot do. To be honest with you, if you take a look at surveys done on Singaporeans when it comes to participating in Buddhist funeral and wake services rites, many will do. They just reinterpret it to what they think it should mean. Yeah, so there are different ways. I mean, there are so many boundaries. Where do you draw the line, right? So these are some things that we need to think through and be wise on. To be of good witness to people, like what he said, you know, to be of a good what?
A good son.
A good son, yeah. You know, where do you draw the line, you know? So. It's a good question, right? So that's why these questions are very important to us. We have to think through. Or do you not go at all, right? I mean, a lot of it is, the next question is, how do Christians determine what is cultural and what is religious? Because some of it is all mixed up together. You know, the Chinese reunion dinner during Chinese New Year is a religious event. But we still participate, but we have a different meaning. We take it differently, you know? So, where do you draw the line?
One point about Higgs is that I don't think it's the correlation so much between the ethnic and religion, but the relationship between the person receiving the imposing the rules and the person related to her or him. For example, you and your mother, which is a sibling and son relationship. That is more critical than the fact that you are ethnic. Because your mother expects you, so we are doing it out of reverence, not because of the belief.
I mean, he's just observing from an empirical point of view. Yeah. So I think these are important things. How do you navigate these things in Singapore? In what ways can Christians cooperate with followers of other faiths to promote common good in the society, right? I mean, we have to cooperate. You have there's no election for Lawrence Wong, right? He will be installed, he'll be sworn in, right? That's what it is. So, I mean, you follow the same leader, and the leader is to promote common good in society, and you work with others, you coexist with other people. And so the different religions sometimes come together on certain issues. what are some of the issues that the religionists, the different religions will... Yeah. That's why when it comes to understanding if there's any difference between religion and culture, you have to ask the person, how do you take this? Is this a culture? Is this religion? If it's culture to them, then I think it's maybe okay. I mean, it's a little bit, you don't want to create misunderstanding, all right? And so my question is that, you know, when it comes to nation building, building a cohesive, harmonious society, you have to work with others. There are common goals the society is trying to reach, right? And so religion still plays a very important part of building a somewhat moral, conservative society today. All the religionists will agree that there are more. It offers a moral ballast to a secularized society like Singapore. So that's where you cooperate. That's where you work with one another. And how should evangelism be carried out in a multi-religious society like Singapore? You know, and so you just do it tactfully, lovingly, and respectfully. All right, so that's all I have. Yeah, so what you allow them to come and worship, right? I don't see why you should not allow them to come. But the we are going through now in the Presbyterian Church in Singapore, we're going through a legal action. We have to change the constitution whereby we are not forced to, let's say, marry, solemnize people of homosexual background, and that we wouldn't get into a hot water legally. Change that as a constitution so, you know, we're protected by our constitution. That's something we have to do for our church in the days ahead. It's coming. But there's no reason why they cannot come in our service, you know. Yeah. There are some here, actually. Yes, of course. What do you mean? We cannot force them to come to this church by virtue of their employment. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But we do it. We employ them, right? We don't directly employ them. What do you mean? So who employs them? Okay. All right. Yeah, contracted. But we don't refuse employment on the basis of their religion, right? Yeah. So, yeah. All right. These are some questions. We're kind of coming to the end. 10 more minutes. You have any questions? This is just my personal view. It's not absolute. I don't think I would have a problem with that. It's out of respect. You don't. You're not going in there with a view or an aim to do worship or anything like that. But you put on a headdress so that they don't stumble. You don't cause them to stumble, and you're showing your respect to them, you know. You're going in there to observe, to look at something, right? Not to do what, not to worship. So I think it should be okay.
So isn't that in the way, like, acknowledging that this, that God is so real?
I mean, putting on the headdress.
Yeah, or even attending or
visiting. I mean, if I visit that site or that venue, as a visitor, as a monument or something, I mean I go in, you know, it's just to look around, right? Not as a worshiper. I think it would be okay. Yeah.
You don't glorify God. To me, this is a false religion that caused millions of people to stumble and go to hell because of this false religion.
Actually confusing the people worshiping that you're not a girl. So their objective is to differentiate you out of
Well, it was not just so-called to differentiate them from a gender issue. At that time there were many temple prostitutes, and by putting a headdress on was to say that you're not one of them. Yeah. So I think this is really hard, right? And you just have to seek the Lord's wisdom and be spirit-led. I would just ask that, you know, make sure that you don't go in there, you stumble other Christians by what you do or where you go, that they don't misunderstand you, and your intentions are clear, you know, so.
There are some questions online.
Okay. A Buddhist family, huh? I think basically when it comes to Buddhist funeral rites, I would not participate in them. There are actually many books written in terms of where Christians draw the line. And the result is that many of us are actually quite open to participating in these rites. But what we tend to do is that, let's say if you ask to hold a jostic or incense, you go, and you go bye, you know, this. Christians will do something like that, but they will change in their mind, and they will tell other people, I'm going to change the meaning of holding a jostic by holding a rose or holding a flower. And what they do is that I do this out of respect for the family, not to worship the dead. All right? And when you clarify this, there's no misinterpretation, then you do this out of respect. So sometimes, you know, I don't know if this is Buddhist or Taoist, and people, they bow to the corpse, bow to the deceased. Okay? Now, I don't do that, but I will go and stand before the deceased, the body, as a way of observe, as a final farewell to say goodbye. But I don't bow to say, oh, you know, you better protect me in the afterlife or something like that, you know. Yeah. So that's why, you know, these intentions have to be clarified, because other people think, well, you are just like them, that there's no difference between what a Christian believes and what a Christian does, right? And so these things are to be, I think, carefully observed. I will not go around with a procession. I will not, you know, I will not buy, and I would probably, you know, I mean, will you eat foods that have been offered to idols? Okay.
Yeah. Or not eat, right? Because we knew it was offered.
Okay.
And then she evolved in her own mind to say, okay, that yeah, she's not going to tell us. So we are not stumbled.
Okay,
sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how she knew that we took a stand.
She's helping you.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that we could eat.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, Paul talks about this, right? I mean, will you eat food that have been offered to idols? I don't remember if this is 1 Corinthians 8 or 10 or where, you know. Don't eat, I mean, if it's a younger or a weaker Christian who don't understand what you're doing, you know, then you should refrain, right? Don't stumble them. But then he says at the end, it's food. It's food. Why should you not eat? You know, so it's just, you just need to clarify these things, and you make sure that the people around you don't misunderstand by what you're doing. You know, I think that's really but there's nothing magical or harmful if you eat that food that's been offered, so long as you don't cause other people to stumble, to misunderstand.
Well,
So you clarify within even with the unbelievers, you know. You tell them, you know. So when my mother and father were still living, and we would go to the Qingming, I mean, what do you call it? So they offer food, they burn the incense, you know, to the dead. And she said, oh, you're not going to eat, right? And I said, well, you know, so long as you know that I don't believe in food offered to ancestors. If you understand what I'm doing, I have no problems eating. I clarify. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
There are two more questions here. One is a legal question. What are the key features of the Religious Maintenance Act? And are there any stipulations in it that may, practically speaking, contradict Christian doctrines and values?
Say that again.
Religious Maintenance Act. Key features. Whether there's anything in it that will contradict.
Does anyone know? Andrew? I don't know how to answer that question legally speaking, right? There's anything legally binding, right? I'm told by the NCCS, the National Council of Christian Churches, that so long as we can say that Jesus is the only way, he's the one and true God, we can say all those things, but we cannot criticize other people. We're okay.
I didn't ask that question, but I have a question related to that.
Oh.
It's not cultural like all the previous questions. So we are going through our A&A, right? We do fundraising. And what if, in the name of religious harmony, the neighboring mosque donates to us?
Oh, yeah. The answer would be no. I did read an article on a number of things produced by NCCS, National Council of Christian Churches, Singapore, that saying that can religious organizations donate money? I mean, can we donate to the Buddhist temple or vice versa? You know, they want to do that. And so from NCCS point of view, not a very good idea. Is not infringing on the law. I have to look at the article. You have to give an explanation why but it should not be a legal matter. I think there, from the Religious Maintenance Act, there is enough buffer to allow for something like that. I mean, I have to look at it legally. I mean, look at it more specifically. Yeah, these are very good questions. Yeah, I don't know then. Okay, so if what you say is correct, that would be, but I think these things, NCCS is trying to navigate and to kind of act like a referee, arbitrator, in giving guidance to Christians on how to maintain your Christian witness, at the same time to be good neighbors to one another. Okay, all right, that's all we have. Thank you very much, and let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, we come to you. We thank you for this time and pray, Father, that you would help us to be good neighbors and to love others as ourselves, but at the same time learn to stand on the truth of the one true God, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Help us to be good witnesses, to share the gospel with others. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.